Hello and welcome to NashyCast.
Ta-da.
I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And this is a Beyond Nashy episode. This is episode 20.5, where we have decided to talk to you about our second, that's right, a second Jess Franco film.
Yes.
Enjoy it
while you're still reeling from the last one. We'll throw another one at you there.
Just like to remind everybody that this being a Beyond Nashy episode, we're not going through the film scene by scene as we do in our normal episodes. We're not going scene by scene, picking over every little thing that we can think of, scene to scene.
Yeah.
We're going to just give you a brief synopsis and then dig into our favorite aspects of the film and just talk about
it
in general.
That's right. We're not going to spoil all the things about the Count Dracula novel that all you horror fans have never experienced, that you don't know.
Here's a question. Honest question. I want you to be flat out honest. I'm going to ask the question.
For once, I will be flat out honest.
Okay. Yes, for once, I want some honesty from you, sorry, bastard. Have you read Bram Stoker's novel, Dracula?
Not only have I read it, I have read it, I would say, a grand total of twice.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
I have read the novel only once, but I have read a graphic adaptation of it as well a couple of times. I was in my, I hate to say this, I was in my 20s before I ever read the novel. Of course, then again, I don't really know what would be the average age of people who finally get around to reading Dracula. I don't know. It's not like it's a school text, I guess.
I'd be interested in the average age or how many people out there start it when they're really young and don't make it through and then pick it up again. Then they pick it up again around their 20s and realize, okay, now I can read this.
Sounds like my tale of woe with fucking Lord of the Rings. But I decided to read Dracula sometime in the mid, I guess it was the mid 90s, when I just, it was just one of those things where it was like, okay, I need to finally read this novel so that I can compare this to the half dozen to two dozen adaptations of the book that I love and adore, just to see what changes are made, what characters are included and taken out, and all this. And I think around that same time I'd read Frankenstein years before. But one of the things that kept dragging me back to Frankenstein was reading absolutely brilliant and creative sequels to Frankenstein written by different authors, people from Fred Saberhagen's The Frankenstein Papers, all the way up to the wonderful memoirs of, Lady Frankenstein, it's memoirs of Elizabeth, Elizabeth Frankenstein.
Yes.
Great novel by Theodore Rozek. I cannot remember how to pronounce his name. I have the book sitting in there on the bookshelf. Anyway, it was always these various imaginative and intelligent sequels to Frankenstein that kept me circling around and reading Frankenstein and even discovering, you know, there are two different versions of the novel. She wrote it, got it published, and then kind of revised it, and it was republished a few years later. But with Dracula, I finally came to it, and it was I was fascinated by it because it is a fascinating novel. It's very interesting. It's told in a bizarre way, and once you get the novel under your belt, it's easy to see, wow, there really is no film adaptation that really adheres strictly to it. But
even the ones that claim to don't.
Yeah, and this film tonight that we're going to talk about does not, but did
make
the claim.
It makes an attempt. It makes probably a better attempt than some of the others have, you know. But it, I mean, as far as like to be more faithful, but ultimately they can't help. Well, you know, you look at the way the novel was written, look at the way the story's told. It's just be very hard to.
That's where I was going. Is just the idea that I don't really know that a strict point by point adaptation of that novel would be very good. You know, the closer you get to trying to follow the structure of the novel, the more it doesn't work as drama on screen. Very interesting. I you know, what's funny is I think there are people who think that like the 1931 Bela Lugosi Dracula film, the Universal horror film, I think they think that's an adaptation of the novel. It's like, guys, that was a stage play.
Stage play, which is very different from
but
And you're right, most adaptations choose to eliminate at least one of the characters. You know, at least one. And sometimes, I mean, usually more than that.
Well, Arthur Holmwood is usually jettisoned, and the names get kind of messed around, as we'll talk about.
As we'll see in this guy. I bet I know who's read the book.
Who?
Christopher Lee. And therein lies the genesis of this film we're talking about tonight.
Yes, indeed. We are, of course, talking about Jess Franco's adaptation of Dracula, known as Count Dracula, 1970 film. This was seen by many as an adaptation, an attempt to do a closer adaptation than had been done on film before. Mm-hmm. Christopher Lee was willing to be involved in this because he is a huge literary aficionado. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, honestly, I get the impression he's probably read Dracula many, many times. I
think probably he was, so. Well, he's the reason that a lot of films got made by Hammer, simply because he brought the attention of the producers to these things because they were such storied literary works, or at least highly praised bits of pulp/horror fiction, things like The Devil Rides Out and things of that nature.
I don't think it's any secret that he wasn't always pleased with what Hammer did with those films.
Well, of course not, and he was never very pleased with what Dracula turned into past the first film, past Horror of Dracula. Of course, there are legendary stories about them begging him to do the various sequels for various reasons, and his anger at the quality of the scripts and his anger at what was being done.
But, well, they're always like, yeah, Chris, we'll give you dialogue this time, and, we'll do this.
Well, that's the thing. That's the legendary story about the third one, which is the second one he played Dracula in, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, he doesn't have a line of dialogue in it, and they wrote dialogue. There was supposed to be things that Dracula said in the movie. He just refused to say it all.
Oh, really? So what they wrote was so bad, or what he thought was
terrible. And what's terrible about that is I like Dracula, Prince of Darkness. I think it's a heck of a film.
I do too.
But as a matter of fact, their first three Dracula films, I think, are a blast. But,
yeah, me too.
Let's just say that what I would consider fun and interesting and good, and what Lee would consider fun and interesting and good, are miles apart.
I would imagine so.
So there you have it. It was apparently an easy sell to get Christopher Lee to do this, because this really was an attempt to try to be more. To adhere more closely to the novel in both its structure and in its treatment of Dracula as a character.
You can totally see why he must have just been really chomping at the bit to do something like this, why he had such high hopes for it and to be involved with it. Somebody who was actually going to, we will portray Dracula the way he's written in the book.
And we'll get into the pitfalls and problems of this particular production as we go along.
Right.
But before we go on, let us make mention that, remember, if you want to try to get a hold of us, you can either contact us through the Facebook page, the NashyCast Facebook page. Go over there and like us, because we like you.
Mm-hmm. Without even knowing you, without even having met you, we like you.
Or you can send us an email at NashyCast@gmail.com. We'll be glad to hear from you. Mm-hmm. We'll be addressing a few emails at the end of the show, as we do in most episodes, if not all of them, for the past year or so. Drop us a line, keep in contact with us, let us know what you think. Let us know if you think we sound funny, weird, or strange. Also, definitely let us know when we screw up, because I guarantee you we're going to keep babbling until we screw up. That's just the way it is.
If we sound congested, it's fall in Tennessee. That's all we have to say.
It's really all we can say. Between the sniffing, the coughing, and the fact that my voice will occasionally pop completely out of the sound range of the human ear, I apologize now, but we'll do what we can. Next regular NashyCast episode will be focused on the Beast and the Magic Sword, so keep that in mind. What we're hoping to do is, like I say, our next 0.5 episode, our next Beyond Nashy episode, will be focused on Horror Express, because the long-awaited Blu-ray of that is set to come out.
Can't wait.
Supposed to come out sometime in October, probably late October. Whenever we get our grubby paws on it, that's when we'll start planning to do the Beyond Nashy episode on Horror Express. So, couldn't be more excited if I tried.
Man, long time coming.
Long time coming. So, with that, unless there's anything else that either of us can think of,
I think of nothing.
Okay, my mind is a blank as well. We will now take a quick break. I'll play the opening music from Jess Franco's Count Dracula, and we'll get into our discussion of Same. first things first, 1970s Count Dracula. Quite a cast.
Man, I know. That was an amazing cast he's got to work with here.
Not just Count Dracula being played by the legendary Christopher Lee, mm-hmm. also playing Von Helsing, Professor Abraham Von Helsing, we have legendary Herbert Lom. Mm-hmm. Now, most people are going to know Herbert Lom from
the Pink Panther films. Inspector Dreyfus.
Exactly. Of course, he was in a bazillion films. The Lady Killers. He has a great role in Cronenberg's adaptation of The Dead Zone. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Oh, man. I can't remember where I first saw him. It was probably in The Pink Panther.
Probably here, too. Yeah, I watched those awfully young.
He was in so many movies. It's always amazing to see him pop up. I mean, he was in Mark of the Devil, Journey to the Far Side of the Sun, the 1970 Dorian Gray, Murders in the Rue Morgue, the director's name. And now The Screaming starts, which is a neat little British horror film. Most people are going to know him from the Pink Panther films as the increasingly more crazed and homicidal Inspector Dreyfus. Easy to identify with him.
You know, it's amazing how much his voice, and I think for the most part, most of the actors are voiced by their own, are doing their own voices, dubbing their own voices.
Obviously,
Lee definitely is, but Lom, there's times when Lom actually sounds to me like Anthony Hopkins from Francis Coppola's Dracula. You know, not constantly, but sometimes the way he phrases things, and when I close my eyes, I would listen, I think, boy, sometimes he really sounds like Anthony Hopkins in the same role as Van Helsing.
Well, one of the things that I think is neat is Herbert Lom's voice is very distinctive. Once you've heard him, it's really kind of hard to forget what he sounds like. Mm-hmm. And what's wild is you can go back to, I mean, he played Captain Nemo in Mysterious Island, the Harryhausen film.
Oh, yeah.
And his voice, it's like his voice never changed.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like he got older and it got gravelier or anything like that. He seemed to always have the same voice, stretching all the way back to those, you know, to earlier films and things like that. It was always quite strange. The only film that I've seen him in where I think Lom's voice sounds different, I think he was trying for this, is the Hammer version of Phantom of the Opera, Terrence Fisher's Phantom of the Opera.
I remember the
film.
He
plays the Phantom.
Yeah, I remember that.
And his voice, it's like he affected something different with his voice. My memory of it is his voice, you can recognize it's him, but it's like he was damaged by what was done to him.
Interesting.
But other than that, I mean, it's always the same voice. And it's like over a 30-year period of listening to him in different films, it's like it's the same damn voice all the time.
Cool.
Which may not seem that bizarre, but it really is kind of odd in a way, considering, you know, 3 decades and your voice never changes.
That is odd.
But love Herbert Lom, and it's just a masterstroke to have him playing Van Helsing.
Yeah.
Third big name in the film, Klaus Kinski playing Renfield.
Mm-hmm. And yeah,
always love seeing Klaus Kinski in anything because he brings, let's just say, he brings his A game even if he's working with D material.
That's true. That is very true. And having Klaus Kinski play a madman is something of typecasting, I suspect. that's not what you call a stretch.
No, yeah. No. That's, let's just say, crazy motherfucker and Klaus Kinski often are the same phrase.
Yeah. Although, I do find it interesting in this film that every time you hear the screams that are supposed to be Renfield, you never actually see him do it, which leads me to believe that Kinski being the way he is, although certainly, you know, Franco says that he had no problems ever working with Kinski, like a lot of directors did, but it wouldn't surprise me if they wanted him to rage and scream as Renfield and he just flat out refused, and so I think those screams that you hear are maybe recorded later on.
You do know the legendary tale of this film and Kinski, right? The story is...
You have to refresh me.
The story is Kinski had been asked and had refused to be part of a Dracula film.
That's right.
Before. Okay. And so essentially the producer and Franco lied to his ass.
Oh yes.
And didn't tell him that he was playing Renfield. Didn't tell him that this was anything to do with a Dracula story whatsoever.
And if you watch the film, you can certainly see how they did keep that hidden, because there is no point when he interacts with anybody other than Maria Rome and his keepers, you know, and that's
right. Paul Mueller and a couple of, you know, secondary handlers, and Maria Rom. So essentially, well, the legendary story is that the scene with when he kind of manhandles Maria Rom later in the film, that he Maria Rom was married to the producer Harry
Allen Towers.
Harry Allen, yeah, exactly. So when they were shooting that scene, apparently Kinski, this could be a lie. I don't know, but this is the legendary anecdote, is that he grabbed her and pulled her in and said, "I think your fucking husband has me making a Dracula movie." And that could be total BS. I don't know, but it makes for a hell of a story. Watching the movie, he never interacts with Christopher Lee, never interacts with Herbert Lom. Mm-hmm. So it would be very easy to...
Yeah, you would have to think that, unless he was a complete dullard, which he was not, when they haven't made a fly, you would think that would be a little bit of a tip-off there.
I remember that particular psychosis is not something that... is just a trait of the literary character Renfield. True, that's a real psychosis. Yeah, so, selling him on this character being that whacked and having that particular problem probably wouldn't be too hard to do. You're dealing with an actor who's willing to burrow into a character and try to turn it into something, especially if he's playing somebody who's nuts in the first place.
Yeah.
So I can buy it. But now that we've mentioned that little problem in that, the fact that one of the big names in the film, Klaus Kinski...
Yes.
Never interacts with the other two big names in the film.
Right.
Let's talk about the fact that none of the three big names in the film, Lee, Lom, or Kinski, have any scenes together.
Yeah.
This, to me, is the film's biggest failing.
Right. I guess you have... Dracula does want one time, towards the end of the film, does appear briefly to... that's a really bizarre scene too, because he does appear once to Van Helsing. It's a very short scene.
Appears to him. Yes.
Appears to him because Van Helsing then sets the fire that's in the shape of the cross, and Dracula leaves again. And like I said, that's just bizarre because where it's placed really kind of seems really out of timing and out of text with what's going on the rest of the film. It seems very oddly placed, almost as if suddenly, they just... thought we've got to, or they just filmed the scene, said we got to stick it in here somewhere. But it's very strange. You're right. The very way those three major characters never actually interact with one another. I mean, usually that's one of the, the strong points of Van Helsing being Dracula's biggest adversary, and then there's always the point where they sort of confront each other and.
Yeah, and this film doesn't have that. They found a way. Obviously, they only had Lom for a certain number of days.
Yeah.
And they shot all of his stuff, and they may not have even... I mean, Lom may not have even been filming when Lee was filming. That would be my guess.
And does that also account, I guess, for this having him suffer this stroke during the film where he's suddenly wheelchair-bound and not able to go on some of the other things that the other characters do?
Right, so he's not able to make the trip to Transylvania where the, with the traditional end of the story. Well, wait a minute. Now, here's the thing. Do you think there's anybody listening to this podcast that doesn't know at least the broad strokes of the Dracula story? Let's do
when this. that's sort of like going to get your master's before you've gone to kindergarten, and that sort of like
that would be. I don't know, man. I don't know. Yeah. Well, let's broad stroke it real quick. Boy, that sounded dirty. Stroke it.
Yeah, we're gonna stroke.
We're gonna stroke. Let me try again. Okay, Dracula. Basic story. 500-year-old, roughly, Count Dracula, near the end of the 19th century, has decided to buy some real estate near London, move to England, and begin a new life. It's a romance. No, I'm kidding. Okay.
So, in the hands of some filmmakers, it has been.
In the hands of more than just one or two filmmakers. That's been one of the very interesting things. Anyway,
yeah.
So Dracula buys some real estate, usually Carfax Abbey, although it's not really named in this film.
Right.
Deals with a couple of, depending on which version of the story you're watching on film, real estate men, one of whom is named Renfield, who goes nuts, and the other named Harker, who completes the deal but kind of suffers for it. And then the rest of the story is essentially Dracula coming to England, and it's
Dracula usually manages to find out that Harker / Renfield, whoever they're using as the hero in this case, whatever, usually Harker has a fiance who's quite appealing, and so part of his coming to, even though he's planning on coming to London anyway, he also has his plans, and when he gets there, he's going to seek her out. He sort of targets her as, you know, as his next victim.
And part of this is that Dracula regains his youth slash extends his life as a vampire through the drinking of people's blood, and the implication is almost always that it needs to be a younger person. Mm-hmm. And in general, especially on film, it's almost always women. Mm-hmm. So, makes sense to me. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what I would do. But those are the broad strokes of the story. If you've never read the novel, I recommend. Mm-hmm. There are some great. There are even some great just books on tape, or you know, I guess they call. I don't even call them books on tape. Mm-hmm. Audiobooks. That's audiobook versions that are the complete text that are really well worth listening to.
And if of course, on this DVD, you get about an hour and a half of Christopher Lee reading Dracula, which is a great treat.
Which is very nice. We should mention, for those interested, that the version of the film that we're watching or that we're dealt with is the 2006 DVD release from Dark Sky Films. It presents the movie in an almost complete form.
Right.
we'll discuss in a moment the one thing definitely missing from it, which is minor but irritating. It's a full-frame presentation, and I'll be honest, I think that's probably the best way to see it.
Yeah, I was wondering if the film was... It really doesn't... You don't get the sense of it missing anything there, which makes me feel that the ratio it was filmed in must have been pretty close
to the Academy ratio. I could see maybe it being shown at about 1:66, but anything past that, and you're going to be trimming image off of it.
Yeah.
And with the way a lot of things are framed, it'd be incomprehensible at times. You'd be lopping off information at the top and the bottom, and so this is probably the best way to see it.
Yeah.
The DVD is quite good. The best extra, as you said, there's a neat interview on there with Franco. I
really enjoyed the interview with Franco. It was really
and there is this long chunk where Christopher Lee reads huge pieces of a novel. Mm-hmm. Very entertaining. One of those things that I really like. Lee has done this kind of thing before. The MGM DVD release of The Hound of the Baskervilles, the Hammer film, there's a brief extra on there of him reading excerpts from the original novel, the Conan Doyle novel. Mm-hmm. And that's very fun. I remember saying at the time, boy, that more DVDs should have extras like this. So apparently Dark Sky listened to me.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dark Sky. Nevertheless, those are the broad strokes of Count Dracula. Now let's talk specifically about this film a little bit more in detail. We'll get to the female leads and some of the ancillary characters as we go along. First of all, I love the cast, and this is one of those films, I wouldn't say it's saved by the cast, because there's a lot of interesting things. I guess I should state right up front that you and I may differ on this film a bit, because I actually like the movie. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a great movie, mm-hmm. but a lot of people seem to despise it. Mm-hmm. I went looking for a kind of critical overview of it online just to get mm-hmm. a sense of what the general attitude amongst genre fans mm-hmm. were, just what the general ideas tossed mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. about the film. And actually, I came away realizing that with the release of the Dark Sky DVD, it appears that the attitude amongst genre fans kind of jumped up a bit from, I think, mm-hmm. what it had been for years before, mm-hmm. which is very good, because, I think that may be the reason. But in general, everybody seems to kind of say the same thing. It's heavily flawed, but overall, it's not a bad little film. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's where I fall. Mm-hmm. I think it is heavily flawed. I think there are some problems, but there are also some extraordinary elements, some things in it that I think are wonderful, and I definitely love the attempt. If nothing else, I got to give them points for the attempt. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that everything works.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, there's one scene in the movie that, oh man, just needs to be carved out. It's just embarrassing. We'll talk about that when we get closer.
Okay. Yeah, I'm wondering if it's the one that I think you're going to say. It'd be interesting if you say.
It's got to be, because there's anyway. Let's talk a little bit about the film. Starts off shaky for me, mm-hmm. because the film starts off with a triple zoom.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, as we are
just
introduced,
as love his zooms.
Which I understand why he had to do it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he had almost no time because they were filming on. They had to set dress and film. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With a train at a train station. And so I'm sure he had like next to no time and had to get it as quickly as he could. But the triple zoom as your first shot is just that thing that makes you go, oh my God, and this is a period piece? Oh, you're not helping yourself, man. You're not helping yourself in the slightest. I was impressed. This is my third or fourth time seeing this film over the years. I have to say, I think the first time I saw it was on VHS tape years ago. I rented it probably sometime in the 90s. Going back through this time, one of the things I kept looking for, was ready to make some evil notes about, was what I kept waiting for were anachronistic things. I kept waiting to spot the car in the background or a telephone pole or something like that. And so my eyes were, I'm there all the time. I'm looking.
Right.
And I really couldn't spot anything that I would consider a definite anachronism.
I agree. I felt the look of the film, the sets, the costuming and all that, considering the budget they probably had to work on, I thought that I thought they did a pretty good job of creating the time. I didn't find
that. I will say the only thing that kind of kicked up my sense of, I don't know if that looks quite right for, 1895 or, 1897 or whenever this is supposed to take place. The only thing that bothered me was the look of Renfield's padded cell.
Because there's times when it's, there's times when it shows the doctor walking out through basically what is just an open, it's not even a doorway. You can tell that they just basically stood up a wall around Renfield, around the character, around the set. Because here's a guy who's basically supposed to be a confined madman, and you just see them walk through what's basically the end of, it's two panels, there's no door there, they just walk through, and that looked a little cheap.
Not even that. I mean, just the look of the padded walls.
I kept wondering,
and I don't know, I kept wondering, did they have padded cells like this back in the late 1800s?
I see what you're saying.
They very well could have. But I don't know, and what little research I was able to do didn't turn up any definitive.
But you're right,
answer,
you would expect it to be more like, you would picture it to be more like just straight brick or something, or just, concrete, or just
something. I really don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question.
But that's the only thing. I kept looking at that and thinking, it seems a little too modern, but like I say, I could be completely wrong.
And really, to me, one of the best... I mean, I know what you're saying about the camera zoom to start it all off, but on the whole, this opening sequence, the whole opening part with Harker and Dracula is really, to me, probably the best part of the film.
Oh, I think it's fantastic.
It's true that it's, and this is part of the problem with the film with me. By the way, I do not despise it. I'll go ahead and say that. You may still have a like it a little more than me.
All right.
I definitely do not. Really, I don't think it's a bad film at all. I would not call it a bad film at all. I do feel like, we'll get into this a little bit later. I'll tell my real problem with it, and it's not even really a problem with the film itself. But I think like this whole opening sequence with Harker, where he goes to visit Dracula, it's hitting all the same beats that we've seen a million times before. Staying in the tavern, everybody giving him weird looks. Tells him where he's going.
The Borgo Pass.
There's so many times we've seen that. It's not easy to make that interesting. But I think that he has some scenes of real atmosphere in there.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, and I know you're the same way too, is I'm not about to knock a film because they have to use German shepherds instead of wolves. I mean, can you imagine the budget they'd have to be able to use real wolves? And I mean, I'm not going to like knock a film for, because those scenes with the dogs are still pretty effective. I mean, them in the woods, I mean, they still manage to make them pretty atmospheric, even if like, okay, they're using dogs, not wolves. I mean, I'll let it slide. I'm going to be like, okay, yeah, it'd be great if they could have used wolves, but...
I do have to knock them for the shitty bad effects, though.
Oh, the bad effects are bad.
But as you were saying.
Yeah. So I mean, I like this whole opening third here, the best of really of the whole film, I think, is really my favorite part with it,
Cool. I mean, I agree with you that you're right. Anybody who's seen adaptations or read the book, I mean, the Borgo Pass, basically it's just a question of, how does this adaptation handle those elements? Does it give you that kind of neat thrill of seeing it in a different, slightly different way? Yeah. Or how are they filming it? How are they looking at it? I was very pleased that that the actor playing Dracula played the servant who comes to meet him at the Borgo Pass. Exactly. I really like that. With the mask up over his face. Yeah. But if you know the actor, then you know who it is, and it's very effective.
And there's certain lines that are just nice. That it's been a while. I know some lines are lifted straight from the novel, and I'm sure certain aren't. It's been too long since I read the novel to know a lot of them. But you know, the thing where he offers him the flask of whiskey, you know, when he's before he's a stagecoach, said it will give you courage or something like that. Yeah, you know, yeah. I just think that's a kind of nice little line there. And
that's great like stuff. That. I love the look of, well, first of all, I love the look of Dracula because the idea, this was the first adaptation to do this, where when you first meet Dracula as this real estate deal is being put together there in Transylvania, he's a much older man, white-haired, large white mustache, and he looks like an older guy. The makeup on Lee is not, I mean, they're making Lee up to look older than he was at the time, and it's not fantastic, but it gets across the point. And the white hair, white wig and everything definitely gets
and it's
across
something
the point.
That most of the adaptations have not attempted, you know.
Correct.
Probably until you have to go, I mean, I know Francis Coppola's did, I mean, do it, but, you know, but it had a little bit more of the freedom of a more modern production to do that, but most adaptations did not have the courage really to present Dracula, and even Coppola's version is basically a romance. But and this once again will probably surprise no one out there listening, but you know, Dracula is not presented as a romantic creature, as a romantic being in the original novel. He's actually presented as quite loathsome and quite unattractive, and there's no sense of romance about him. And even though they don't go, I don't think they go all out to make him quite as unappealing as he is in the book, and it still is Christopher Lee. He still looks great even as an old man, you know, but at least they let him, they do go through those beats of the fact that he's drinking the blood makes him younger as the film goes on. And I think that I think it's great that they were willing to present it that way.
I really like the fact, well, let's not forget that one of the underlying currents of the story itself, and especially the novel, the way Stoker wrote it, was a clash of the old world and the new, with London and these younger people standing in for the new world, and Transylvania and Count Dracula standing in for the old world. And it's the underlying theme of the novel is a clash of old and new.
Yeah.
And so the novel always paints, I mean, it would be completely against what Stoker was really doing in the novel to paint Dracula as a romantic figure.
Right.
Because the novel paints him as nothing but this vile, loathsome creature come to try to suck off the blood of the young to sustain this ancient, horrible thing that needs to be put down.
Yeah.
To kind of roll it into a ball, I guess. So, although I really enjoy the various versions of Dracula on screen that have turned it into a romance, I guess starting with the Dan Curtis version with Jack Palance in 72 or 73, I guess. I think that's the first, that may have, was that, I think that was the first one that turned him into a romantic character. I could be wrong there.
It sort of weighs between that and Nashe's Count Dracula's Great Love. You know, it's kind of like a, but of course that was not an adaptation of the novel. If you're talking about direct adaptations of the novel, it was the first one to really present Dracula as a romantic figure. Actually, adopt the novel in that way.
Yeah, and since then that particular kink in the story has reoccurred again and again and again. Interestingly enough, I mean, it works, but at the same time goes completely counter to what Stoker was really aiming at as the underlying theme of, or one of the underlying themes of what he was writing.
So. Yeah. Have you seen Dracula Pages from a Virgin's Diary?
Oh, the guy Madden?
The ballet, yes.
The ballet, yeah, it's a fascinating movie.
If anyone out there hasn't seen that, I highly recommend it because it's Dracula done as a ballet and as a silent film, and also it really has a great kind of slightly satirical edge to it, in the sense that it really kind of takes all the underlying themes of Dracula and brings them to the forefront in a very fun way. And in fact, you know, not only is Dracula really about the clash of old versus new, but a lot of it has a lot of people have read it as a clash of, you know, West versus East, and the fact that Dracula in this movie, and Dracula Pages from a Virgin's Diary, he's actually played by an Asian, you know, but there's some very fun stuff in there. So if anybody out there hasn't seen it, I highly recommend it. A very entertaining film.
It really is. I'm far from being a big ballet fan.
Not that I
hate it or anything, but that's exactly the, it's such a bizarre melding a horror tale and ballet, and to choose to film it the way he did as a black and white silent film with only musical accompaniment is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
But back to this film.
Yes, yes.
The dinner scene, you're right about the dinner scene between Dracula and Harker. I think that it's fantastic. The red tablecloth on that table, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, as Harker's eating, mm-hmm, and Dracula's looking over the paperwork. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a great scene. Mm-hmm. It's just this absolutely amazing thing. And the speech in that sequence that Dracula gives, the whole thing with somewhere in there he says the blood of Attila is in these veins. And,
yeah.
And it's just this absolutely amazing speech. And I love the fact that as we're spending a bit more time with Dracula, with Lee as Dracula, he's got the fangs.
Yeah.
But he never draws attention to them.
Right.
They're there as if they're just always there, of course.
Yeah.
But he's not doing anything, yeah, you know, well, overt with them.
It's, yeah, I got to give props to whoever designed the fangs for the film, is because I'm sure any actor will tell you that it's never easy to talk, yeah, wearing vampire fangs. And yet whoever did it obviously did a great job of making it such that Lee could wear them and not look awkward. Even though, yes, I realize he's dubbing in his own voice here, but still, he doesn't look awkward when he's trying to talk with them. But you see them, you know, but they did a really great job of making it something that he could speak with and act with.
Yeah, yeah. Well, wait a minute, we've got, why don't we play that speech?
Yes, let's hear that. It's a wonderful moment.
Your wife?
No, I'm not married yet, but the lady on the left is my fiancée.
And the other?
Miss Lucy Westerner, her closest friend.
Charming.
Thank you. Forgive me for asking, sir, but why do you plan to live in England?
I am not young, and yet I am restless.
And what about this great castle? It is, I presume, the family home.
True. The shadows of my past remain here. We are the Second Magyars. We have a right to be proud. But in us flows the blood of many brave races. The blood of Attila is in these veins. To us was entrusted for centuries the guarding of our lands. The Lombard, the Bulgar, the Turk poured their thousands against our frontiers. We drove them back. The Draculas have ever been the heart's blood, the brains, the sword of our people. One of my race crossed the Danube and destroyed the Turkish host. Though sometimes beaten back, he came again and again against the enemy. Till at the end he came alone from the bloody field, for he alone could triumph. This was a Dracula indeed. Now, the wind blows coldly through the broken battlements. Though this is my home, I must move on.
I don't regret my journey, but surely the post might have served you much easier and far cheaper.
If I am to begin a new life in a new land, I must learn something of its people from such as yourself. You are my honored guest. Listen to them, the children of the night. What music they make. But you are weary. You shall sleep late.
You are most gracious, but my employers, your solicitors, expect me back in London.
We shall see. But for now, you are here at my invitation, nay, at my command.
I love his delivery of that speech.
Oh, it's wonderful.
It's really, I love it all the way across the board.
And I have to also commend them for not using the same wolf, the same wolf howl that has been used. They actually came up with something a little weird and different sounding for it.
I really like the sound of that all the way across the board. I should say, the English dub is pretty respectable.
I agree. I thought it was pretty damn good.
And not just because of the fact that it appears that most of the actors are doing their own dubbing, especially Kinski, Lam, and Lee, but also just the dubbing itself is well done.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit more literate than some instances you would think of.
Yeah.
And the feel of it is right.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it means so much that the actors dubbing it, you know, doing their own voices, knowing exactly how the, you know, what the story is, what the actors are trying to go for, you know, that's pretty, I think that's great.
Well, now, I want to talk about some more of the things in the movie that really blow me away. First of all, I'm not sure why they chose to do it this way, but our first look at the brides, that ghostly, you see them rise up out of their
I really like that
coffins. It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, the coffins never move. They're always open, and it's almost like their spirits are rising up and becoming flesh. I like that very much. That's one of the best things in the film to me. One of the best ideas that was. Yeah,
it's incredibly creepy looking. Mm-hmm. It was almost a disappointment once you realized they had become flesh.
Yeah,
because that look was so fantastic.
Yeah, I know, it was nice. Yeah.
But the whole sequence is nice.
Mm.
Really like that. I mean, it's like you have the shitty bat on the string and a scene like that. It's almost like, oh, yeah, it almost counterbalances there. So, okay, that's good.
Speaking of voice now, there's probably a couple of voices that are not the person doing it pretty obviously. I don't know if that's Jack Taylor doing his own voice because I have no idea what Jack Taylor's voice. But I'm sure you got a chuckle as well as I did of Jess Franco himself.
Yes.
Playing one of the guys, servant at the asylum, being voiced by a Cockney, you know, British actor.
Yes.
That was definitely not Jess Franco doing his own voice, but I got a big kick out of that.
I'm sure it wouldn't have been this way in 1970 if I'd seen this movie then, but now I have to say that seeing Franco pop up in a small role in one of his films really just yanks me right out of it, just automatically. Just makes me go, oh, geez. Yeah, hey, Jess, how's it going?
Hey, you know? Yeah, we see your cameo there. Yeah.
How you doing there? Yeah. Well, one of the funnier things, though, is that Maria Rahm, who plays...
I don't know if I've told you about my obsession with Maria Rahm.
Maria Rahm, she plays Mina. Mm-hmm. You got a thing for Maria Rahm?
Oh, very, very much so.
Really? I mean, I'm usually the one, you know, drooling, lusting, and making strange sounds. Tell me.
No, it's her eyes. Well, when I saw her in
Hold on. When did you first become aware of your problem with Miss Rahm? Tell us.
It's the it was probably in the Jess Franco's the Eugenie. And then Venus and Furs. So I saw a couple of Francos with her in it, I just think the woman's got some of the most amazing eyes in movies, and you know, I just think she's incredibly lovely.
We should point out that if you would like to be catty about it, it's tempting to point out that the reason Maria Rahm had a movie career was because she was married
to Harry Allen Towers.
the producer.
You could very well say that.
And you wouldn't probably be too far off the beam because she didn't
She
didn't really work in a lot of other stuff.
Exactly.
She was in several Franco films that he produced, and Vengeance of Fu Manchu. Million Eyes of Sumeru, Bloody Judge, Venus and Furs, as you mentioned. Yeah. This Dorian Gray. I'm very curious to see that she was in the 1972 Treasure Island as Miss Hawkins.
That is bizarre.
That's really odd. She was in Black Beauty too in 71. Here's my question. By the way, there is one point I have to say where Maria Rahm looks right at the camera.
Oh yeah, she does.
It was just like, what the hell? What are you doing, woman? Don't look at the camera. Freaking hell! I mean, she is beautiful.
Well, I'm not sitting here saying she's one of the great thespians.
She is absolutely gorgeous. But I gotta tell you, I think Soledad Miranda is much amazing. More attractive. Yeah. I mean, she's just a beautiful. That face of hers.
And Franco tells about how that. He ran into opposition first, you know, for a lot of people did not think that she was going to be right for this particular role. And he was talking about how she really won, including Christopher Lee. And she really won Christopher Lee over very quickly with how well she did the role.
That's just it. It's one of the great tragedies of her untimely death.
Oh, yeah, it's a sad story.
It's really horrible to know that she never really got the chance to keep going. I mean, she made, most of her films that anybody are ever going to see are Franco films. Mm-hmm. Count Dracula, Vampire's Lesbos, She Killed in Ecstasy, Eugenia Sex Happening. She's absolutely mind-bendingly gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
And it's clear that she had... that the camera loved her, and she had mm-hmm. some talent mm-hmm. behind her. She honestly seemed to have the ability to mm-hmm. go far. Mm-hmm. And her unfortunate accidental death cut that career short, and it's terrible because you can see in this film, not only is she beautiful, she's got something. There's mm-hmm. just something there mm-hmm. that you cannot avoid, and she's lovely in this movie. She is. And later on, when she becomes creepy, mm-hmm. let's just say, wow, she's effective. And it's mm-hmm. there's certain moments, just little looks, just little glances from her, just glances from her eyes, mm-hmm. a certain way of holding her face. Mm-hmm. Very, very nice, very creepy, and a very beautiful woman. And she's... she adds something to this that one could argue somebody else could have played the role.
Yeah.
But there's just something about her. I mean, she brings a little something to it that it's hard to define. It's hard to nail down. It's all presence, and it's all just the way some people look good on camera. Some people seem to be able to translate better to film than others. And she was definitely one of them. It's just a tragedy. But Maria Rahm, we have two beautiful women here.
Both of them.
And honestly, I guess Maria Rahm is the more classically beautiful woman, but mm-hmm. Soledad is where my money is every time. Oh, we should mention another returning player, Jack Taylor.
Oh, yeah, we love Jack Taylor.
Gotta love Jack Taylor. Mm. Here he plays one of our heroes. He is Quincy Morris.
Yes, essentially playing Arthur Holmwood named mm-hmm. Quincy Morris. And this is one thing we talked about. Those two characters especially are either both going to be left out or they will be combined in some way. I think it's rarely do you see, you know, there's only been a couple of adaptations where you get all out, you know, get both of them.
Agreed.
In this case, obviously Quincy Morris was the Texan in the novel, but in this case, you know,
he's British.
Arthur Holmwood was sort of the more upper class British guy, and so yeah, he's basically Jack Taylor's playing Holmwood, but being named Quincy Morris. But it's great to see him, though.
Yeah. It's great to see him. Always love to see Jack Taylor, mm-hmm. and you know, a lot of people talk about how he's not. He's the wooden Indian, not the most expressive actor in the world. Honestly, he's pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoy seeing him in this.
And he gets about the film's only moment of real visceral violence where he gets the face full of blood, you know. Because really this film is pretty tame with the gore and pretty pretty pedestrian in the way it depicts its violence and its attacks. But there's one, which makes it all the more jolting. You've come to the point to expect, like, boy, this is really going to be a very tame film, and then he gets the face full of blood at one point, you know. But yeah, he reacts. I agree. He does fine in his role. You know,
I think he's good in this. Yeah. He definitely emotes. He's mm-hmm. almost an action hero to a degree. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in that final third where mm-hmm. it's just him and one other character. It's just him mm-hmm. and the Harker character.
Yeah.
You know, getting to Transylvania and doing all these things that they've got to do.
Yeah.
I really enjoy Jack Taylor in this film. He's a blast. I love the sight of the sleeping Dracula in his coffin there in Transylvania before we shift to London.
Mm-hmm.
I think he looks very creepy. That's a very well done thing. Also, there are a lot of neat Dracula things in it. First of all, he does get younger as the film goes on, mm-hmm. as he drains more blood and claims more victims. And that absolutely fantastic kind of shadow fade that they do with Dracula when Lucy discovers him.
Right, I know what you're talking about.
Mina discovers him attacking Lucy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that bizarre shadow fade, that's really well done and a neat effect. Very mm-hmm. obviously easy to do to a certain degree technically.
Yeah.
And something that wouldn't be a huge budget buster. Damned effective.
I was sorry that they did not depict one of the creepier things that Dracula does in the novel, which of course the famous climbing down the walls. But at the same time, when I see how the bat turned out, I'm like, maybe it's a good idea that they just left that one alone, you know. But it would have been nice to. I was kind of surprised they didn't try it, just because of how faithful they were trying to be to the character, because that is one of the most stunning moments from the novel, is when Harker looks out the window and literally sees Dracula climbing straight face down the wall of the castle there. It's a pretty, pretty shocking moment.
Yeah, it's the first real supernatural. Well, actually, the first supernatural thing that we get in this film is they pull the old mirror trick.
Yeah.
Where
very early on,
yeah, very early on, he shows him to his room there in the castle, and Harker looks in the mirror, sees himself, but doesn't see Dracula reflected. Also, one thing about Jack Taylor, how creepy is it to see Jack Taylor without a mustache? That's just not good. That's wrong.
It is strange, isn't it?
It really kind of weirded me out.
It's like, oh, you do have an upper lip, Jack. And it's a strange thing.
And it's a big. It's like rewatching The Fog recently and realizing that Tom Atkins isn't wearing a mustache in that, and he's got too much freaking lip. I mean, there's like this gigantic. There's like 60 yards of space between his mouth and his nose. It's like you need some fur in there, dude. That it's just not right. It doesn't work. But yeah, the Jack Taylor without a mustache, that should be outlawed.
Yeah.
That should be outlawed.
Well, it's just like seeing frogs. We watched Frogs again recently. Sam Elliott without a mustache. No, that's just wrong. Yeah. It's like, that's the only time he shaved since he was 3 years old for that movie.
Or Tom Selleck without a mustache. It's like, oh my God, what the fuck are you doing? It's so weird. You look back at like Gator or one of those early Burt Reynolds movies when he wasn't Longest Yard he wasn't wearing a mustache.
Deliverance,
And and it's like he almost looks okay, but doesn't look quite right. Mm-hmm. There's I don't know what it is. You get this image in your head and you can't get it out.
We do probably spend too much time on Nashy Gas talking about men's facial hairs. We've been called out on that before, so sorry if we're making our listeners uncomfortable. We'll
move away from the talk of facial hair now. Yes. The weird Harker's creep through the asylum when he goes and he looks at Kinski, that was a really weird scene, and just it's the first moment in the film where I feel like I'm going, are we losing the plot here? Mm-hmm. And it ratchets back into things just fine, but I just didn't understand why there was either. Of course, as with all adaptations, they make a lot of changes, but they make a real major change to the story of Renfield. He has no connection to Dracula whatsoever.
Exactly. That's really the bizarre.
I mean, he's somebody who Renfield had a daughter that died, and that's why he's in the insane asylum.
I know, which bizarre. Makes it no... So he obviously does have some kind of connection to Dracula, because he's the one who basically with his, you know, basically gives him the clue, or he knows where Dracula is going when he escapes, because he gives him the name of Varna, you know, when Dracula's, you know, leaving to escape the, you know, so, but I mean, it doesn't explain, like, because he doesn't have any prior connection to him,
what is this about?
I mean, Dracula does that scene where he steps out on the balcony of, and Renfield, it causes Renfield to break out of his cell and dive off.
That was bizarre.
A lot of strange things with what
was a nice falling dummy, though.
It was a very nice falling dummy. Did not flop at all, you know.
Good dummy. We've talked before about how Herbert Lom is quite good as Van Helsing. He's quite stoic.
Yeah,
he's very good in the role.
Here's an interesting thing they do with Van Helsing. Van Helsing isn't totally the expert vampire fighter. The way they write the character, he knows about vampirism, or he has his suspicions. He knows who Dracula is, but it seems like he's reluctant through a big part of the film to kind of believe his own suspicions. Which I thought was kind of interesting there.
That may come from the fact that they had to structure this thing. Well, let's talk about this openly.
Yeah.
They structure the film so that they don't ever have Van Helsing and Dracula really in the same room.
Right.
Now, they do this in a couple of ways. As you mentioned before, they have him have a minor stroke, and he ends up in a wheelchair, which keeps him from being in the latter part of the film in Transylvania. So I think by having him be the way you were describing a second ago, which is not so sure of his vampire lore or whatever, this gives them another reason to keep the character around in the story without having him start the actions that would take him out of obviously these sets that he's going to be that they're filming him on, and into what needs to happen, which is we need to go over there and find the coffins and break them apart and destroy them and all this, that, and the other, and go from there.
Sure.
So
Yeah,
that is one of the flaws. That is one of the flaws of the film, is that that need or that inability to put those two characters together, or to have Herbert Lom essentially make that trek across the yard, to the other place, is one of the things where the film struggles really to. There comes a point in at about the hour mark, or the hour and 5 minute mark, where you're sitting there going, we know this shit. Why aren't we doing something? Yeah. Why aren't we moving? And I think that's what it is. That's the flaw right there, in that we couldn't have Lom go do this stuff, so we have to kind of spin our wheels for a little bit of time here and gather the information, you know, kind of quote-unquote gather the information. So that's kind of irritating. But I do love the scene where he lays all the information out for the other characters. Mm-hmm. It's good, Will. We can play that sound clip.
Yes,
now,
yes.
Which is really cool. But I gotta say, I'm not sure if it's part of the sound clip. But the whole thing where Jack Taylor's character, it's not Jack Taylor's character. It's the Harker character. Who goes, why can't he be arrested? And I love that.
Yeah,
freaking love. Why can't this vampire be arrested?
It's a legitimate question. It's a legitimate question. Nobody ever asked it. You know, really, but it's
why can't he be arrested? But here we go. This is Herbert Lom laying out the lore of Dracula.
In my search for the secrets of the black arts, this is what I found and what concerns us now. May I? Known through legend in such diverse countries as Greece, Rome, France, India, and even China, he doth fatten upon the blood of the living. He can by such nourishment even grow younger. He throws strange shadows when he walks upon the earth. He can transform himself to dog, to bat, to other kinds of beast. He lives by night, for by day he must conceal himself within his grave. Those upon whom he nourishes himself sicken and die, and then become like him, vampires themselves. His name is Dracula.
Why can't this man be arrested?
You underestimate Count Dracula. What good are laws against someone who can set himself above the law? His spirit is all around us. Some of us are completely within his power.
Professor, you know so much about the black arts. Suppose you too are Dracula's servant.
I have never met the Count. And yet I feel I know him better than my own soul.
Alrighty then.
Yep.
There you have it. What do you need? Yes, you probably won't meet Drac, but probably should.
You probably should, for the interest of good storytelling, you probably should
meet him. Probably should have met Drac, yeah. Go ahead.
No, you go.
Well, the look of Dracula's London home is a little too neat and well-groomed for my taste. It seems like it should be a bit more gloomy and decrepit. And I should say that actually one of the...
I know what you're saying. Yeah, I see what you mean. Because they did a great job on his castle, being just stark and cobweb covered and
especially the lower levels where the coffins were. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the problems with this film, especially a film on this budget, which is there's a lot of day for night shooting.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that unfortunately kind of gets a little sloppy, because unless you tint those scenes properly, then it looks a little silly, because we know it's supposed to be at night.
Yes.
But it doesn't really look at night effectively, so there's a little bit of that. But the inside is fine, and I don't think they ever refer to it as Carfax Abbey.
Not that I remember.
But it shouldn't look as neat and pretty as it kind of does. Mm-hmm. I guess they were just shooting where they could. They found a location and shot. Mm-hmm. Let's come to what I would refer to as the holy what the fuck moment of the film. Now, as I've said, I'm on the side of this film. I do kind of like this film. Mm-hmm. On the 1 to 10 scale, I give it a 6. Mm-hmm. Okay. In my feeling, even with all its other flaws, you know, shitty bad effects and all, if you were to take this one sequence out of this movie, I think it could be a 7.
Really?
Maybe. Mm-hmm. Possibly. If I'm being generous. Mm-hmm. Maybe a 6.5, but we don't do those fractions and things of this nature. So here is the scene that sucks the suck of the damned. And that would be the stuffed animal attack.
Oh, yes. The stuffed animal attack. When stuffed animals attack, isn't that like a video, a snuff video or something? It's like,
okay, so they're not really stuffed animals. It's not like a bunch of teddy bears attacking.
Right, right, right. They're
taxidermy animals. It looks... It is fucking lame, people. This is the lamest fucking scene. Attempting to build... I don't know if anybody could have pulled this off. I don't know if anybody could have pulled off the idea that suddenly these grown men are... menaced by stuffed animals. It's just, it's never going to happen. It's not, I mean, maybe there's a way for it to occur. This film doesn't pull it off. It's an embarrassing scene.
I know, because you're expecting the guys, you're expecting the men to go, that's the best you got, Drac? You know, that is the best you got, is to menace us with taxidermied animals?
Yeah,
you know?
So like a stuffed fox? A really ratty-looking owl? Really? This is what's supposed to scare shit out of us? What's with you?
Had they turned into real animals, that would have been an interesting idea. Exactly. To have them turn into real animals until Dracula's concentration is broken and then they turn back into what they were. Okay, that would have been an interesting idea. It would have been like, wow.
Or even if that was just done as a hallucination and his concentration was broken and they came to
right.
and thought they were fighting real, these beasts and realized that no, exactly. that those animals were there to put the idea in their head so that this kind of, a form of kind of distance hypnosis would work, that would be great. That would be fantastic. That's not the scene. what we're left with is something pretty freaking embarrassing, honestly. So that's the point where if you were doing make or break scenes, as another podcast does, that would be the scene where I was almost broken. I was just like, okay, man, no, never. But there's that. But then what's neat is that right after that you have the opera scene where Dracula sends the note to Mina, and she goes to the opera. That whole opera visit sequence is really well done. I love there's a lot of attention to using red lighting in the movie throughout it, and the especially nice in this whole up in the opera box sequence. Very, very nicely done. And in all honesty, in this sequence, in the opera sequence, Maria Rahm's never looked lovelier. She looks fantastic in that whole sequence. I really like that.
I always have a little bit of a problem when Dracula does something that just seems like common. In this case, where he grabs and puts his hand around her mouth and like hauls her out like he's kidnapping her. You know, Dracula shouldn't have to do that. I always thought it would be a little bit more effective if he just sat down and
hypnotized her or something.
You know, something like that. Yeah. It's like when Dracula resorts, you know, it's like he's, you know what I'm saying. It's like that to me was a little bit, I think overall you're right, that's a very effective sequence. It's very nice, you know. It gives the film a feeling of a bigger budget than it had to pull off a big, you know, a full scene like that. And so, yeah, it's a good scene.
It's also around this part of the film where you realize they're really working their asses off to stretch the Renfield stuff across the entire movie.
And it's...
They should have done away... There should never have been that scene with Maria Rahm and Kinski. It's a waste of time.
It is.
And essentially, instead of just being really injured, Renfield's plunge out the window earlier in the film should have killed him.
And that's where you think, like, okay, the character's dead. The next time you see him, he's just got, like, a neck brace on or something.
And that doesn't really work, in my opinion.
No.
I know it's Kinski. You want to, you know, he's a star, you want to stretch his, you know, stretch his screen time across the movie as far as possible. But still, it doesn't really work. When Van Helsing kind of saves Mina by running off Dracula in the scene where it's very obvious that neither actor was there when the other segments were shot. You were talking about the whole flaming cross. You know, using the fireplace poker to carve a flaming cross into the floor,
which Van Helsing leaps out of his chair to do when he's supposed to be wheelchair bound,
which is kind of weird
to think about that. It's like, I know, I saw that. It's like, okay, at the same time that Dracula was supposed to have been like fleeing for Varna or whatever, you know, and in his coffin, you know, that he's under. So I don't know if Dracula was maybe just supposed to be his,
well, that was the story,
you know, they appears, were, you know,
and they see that just did it seemed like he maybe, because they had been at that point, they've mentioned the possibility of him being someplace far distant,
yeah,
physically, and being able to affect things.
Yeah.
So
he may have not been appearing there in his physical self. That right. I can accept. But yeah. when Van Helsing jumps up out of his what was supposed to be his wheelchair by that point, he's awfully nimble for a
if he had fallen done what little he could, that would have been very effective. But yeah, I agree with you.
It does suggest they filmed that scene without really knowing where they were going to put it in the film.
True. So my question becomes to kind of sum up. Mm. Overall, I like the film. Mm-hmm. It's heavily flawed. It's got some real problems, but in general, I like it. But what do you what's your takeaways from what are your takeaways mm-hmm. from the movie? What do you look at when you think of the film? Mm. Before we get to that, I forgot. There's one sequence.
Okay.
There's one scene that is in the French version of the film that really should have been included in this DVD version, and it's. The standard thing at the beginning of the story when the brides come to Harker and Dracula pushes them away, mm-hmm. explaining that this man belongs to him, he offers the brides an infant in a bag mm-hmm. to satiate them. Mm-hmm. And in the French version of the film, there's a scene after this, and it's not even just the French version because I still have a DVD-R of the VHS tape. And this scene was in that version, and that's the English language version as well. Mm-hmm. And what it is a scene of of the mother of this stolen infant coming to the outer walls of Dracula's castle and begging.
Begging for her child back.
For her child back. And it's a shame that scene's not in this DVD version of the film. That is a black mark against the DVD. Yeah,
because the film is so close to being complete, really. Yeah. I mean, I don't think we're missing. It's not like there was an unclothed version of this film or something like that. I mean, we're pretty much getting the film, except for that, as far as we know.
And it's a real shame.
Yeah.
It's almost as if Darkseid didn't have a clue that this was even missing.
It's very possible, I know.
Which is a shame. I mean, at the very least, they could have included it as a deleted scene, but it would have been just a snap to sling it back into the movie in the appropriate place. But it's a real shame that it's not there.
Yeah.
That having been said, back to where I was going, which was, what are your takeaways from the film? When you think back on it, what are the things that kind of stick with you?
Right. I've struggled with my feelings about this film a bit. It was which made it very fascinating. I'm glad we picked this one to do. I think a lot of people weren't necessarily real excited about us doing this one because a lot of what we've gotten back, people are just like, oh God, I'm going to sleep through that episode as I sleep through the movie, but when I first saw a part of the film when I was very young, it actually, when it played on television here, they showed it once. I was excited because I saw, by that point I hadn't seen all the Hammers, but I was pretty much, I'd read enough famous monsters to know what all the Dracula films that Christopher Lee had done for Hammer. And so here I saw a film, Count Dracula, saw starring Christopher Lee. Of course, I knew nothing about Jess Franco at that point, but I thought, wow, a Christopher Lee Dracula film I didn't know about, so I was excited about it, and I didn't make it through the film. And for me not to make it through a Dracula film, it was because I was young and it's a very slow film, It's obvious to see why I dropped out of it after, probably I think I made it about half of it and I just got bored with it. So I had not seen it again until I watched it for this podcast. I watched it twice. It's not any slower. In fact, there's more action in this than the last Jess Franco film we did. So, it's like, we're adults. I mean, I watch foreign films. I mean, it's like I'm used to, I can, a slow film, as long as it holds my interest, it's like that's not an issue anymore. And so I look at it as, but I'd have to say, I like Virgin Among the Living Dead more than this film.
Oh, that's a better
quite
film.
A bit more. But you look at the films, and they're both still about the same kind of feel to them, both pretty, pretty slow films. So that's not an issue with this film. My criticisms about it, or I think why it ultimately is not a film that I think I'll find myself returning to. Mm-hmm. I hate to say these things because really they're sort of indicative of the fact that Franco did a lot of what he set out to do, which is basically tell the story of Dracula and not impose his own personality on it. But see, one of the things that I feel is detrimental to it, it doesn't stand out because it doesn't have enough of Franco's personality in it. Whether that would have been detrimental, whether that could have ultimately been made for just a more fucked up movie or just a more, it's, let's say something, going back to that scene that we've talked about how ridiculous it is, the stuffed animal thing.
Yeah.
Yes, that is...
It's bad shit.
Ridiculous, but it's one of the few parts of the movie where at least I feel like there's Jess Franco being just fucking bizarre. We're in Franco land there, And I have to respect him for stepping back as much as he did to do what he set out to do. You know, he's like, I'm going to tell this story pretty much beat by beat for the most part, you know, and try and tell a faithful story to the point of, you know, it's I think it works against the film in the fact that I think it makes it hard for it to really stand out to me any above any of the other versions of Dracula, you know, because I don't think it... I think it, and I just feel like it could have used more of his weird take on things to make it stand out. And it doesn't even have the, it's not even, other than the fact that the two women are, of course, beautiful to look at, it's a very sexless, unerotic film, which so is the novel. You know, once again, true. That's playing into the novel. But when I look at the vampire, when I look at Dracula's, you know, his attacks on the ladies, I mean, it's like they were far more erotic in the Hammer films, you know, and once again, true. Like I said, these things that I'm saying, it's, I feel like, you know, I feel bad about saying them because I feel like I'm kind of calling Franco out really for doing basically a good job on, you know, doing what he set out to do. But I just feel like when I think of the other versions of Dracula, when I think, you got Lugosi's version, you got the Horror of Dracula, you've got the Jack Palance version, you've got the BBC version with Louis Jordan, you've got Francis Coppola's version. You know, I personally, and I wanted to ask you this too, would you take this version over any of those? Because I personally would not. Not that I feel this is vastly inferior to those versions, but I just feel like it, I don't think it's the equal of any of those versions I just mentioned.
No, I would not.
Yeah.
Now, I will say this. I think I would... It's been a few years since I watched the Dan Curtis Dracula.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I will say I might return to this before I'd return to that one.
And it's also, for me, been... a lot of years since I watched the BBC one, but when I saw it when it first aired on public television, I was very impressed with it. But I've got the DVD of it. I've not rewatched it, and so I would have to revisit that one again too. That's one that I remember as being. And now it is like maybe it's, you know, I know it was like a 3-hour version, yeah. You know, and so obviously they could really go into much more detail with the story. But I remember that as being a pretty effective version.
I need to revisit that version. As a matter of fact, this may be the year that I finally rewatch it because I haven't seen it in well over 10, 12 years.
Yeah.
So it's definitely time to revisit that and watch it again and kind of soak it up and judge it next to these others. But in answer to your question, I've always thought that Dan Curtis's production of Dracula with Jack Palance had a great Jack Palance in it,
sure,
but that the film itself kind of wasn't that great.
Mm-hmm.
I love a lot of Dan Curtis's horror films, productions for television in that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought Dracula was his weakest.
Really?
Yeah. Especially compared to his absolutely fantastic Jekyll and Hyde. With the same actor, with Jack Palance. Right. I think that's head and shoulders above his Dracula by a long shot.
Mm-hmm.
But I like this a little bit more than that, but not the other versions, no. I mean, I love the Lugosi,
even
though I feel that the Spanish version shot at the same time as the
Lugosi better. Film it's is actually, better film. It is better film, yeah.
I think Horror of Dracula is fantastic, although... neither of those films, neither the Universal or the Hammer adaptations or anything like the novel, really. I mean, they're really not.
And again, I really appreciate what this film, how much this film did do what it said it was going to do. You know, did try to capture the spirit of the book. On the second view, I was going to finish up by saying, on the second viewing of the film, as is often the case, I really began to notice nicer touches, things, camera angles I liked, you know, little ideas that I liked that I gave. So it did improve with the viewing, with that I was required to do for the podcast. Once again, I don't know that I would have viewed it that second time had not, you know, I'm glad I did though, because I did come appreciating the film more. But I think my feeling about it right now is I would probably give it a 5. I think that's probably my view of it right now.
I think about 5. In all honesty, like I say, for me it's a 6, but I honestly can understand a 5 easily there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of good, but there's also a lot of stuff that kind of almost counteracts or cancels out some of the goodwill that you have.
Yeah.
I get it. I understand that completely.
Yeah.
As I said, I can see myself returning to this film for the things that I like about it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I'm just a Euro horror nut. I love that period of time when these films were made. There's something about those films from that time that draw me back into them. Good or bad.
Yeah. It would definitely not torture me to watch it again by any means, because there's definitely enough there to like that, it would not be. And you can never have too many versions of Dracula or too many Dracula movies, let's face it, you know.
No, of course not.
Keep them coming.
I have no problem.
I just think I felt like if I had seen like 20 or 30 Franco films, and I suddenly heard, like, you know, Jess Franco did a version of Dracula with Christopher Lee, and I'd be thinking, like, oh my God, that's got to be, you know, just so totally bizarre Bombers, and different, yeah, from, you know, and the fact that it isn't, I was just kind of like, you know, it's, you know what I'm saying? It's like, it could be, well, but I'm not sorry for watching the film at all. I'm really glad that this gave me a chance to come back and revisit it and finally make myself watch the whole film and see the things that are good about it, you know.
Cool, good. So. Well, let me give you my overview of why I, like I say, would put this above, in my estimation, probably not anybody else's, put this a little bit above the Dan Curtis production.
Mm-hmm.
My overwhelming memory of the Dan Curtis Dracula is that it was so fucking overlit.
It did have those kind of TV look.
It was TV lit. Very, yeah, flat lighting.
That's a good point.
Very, you know, let's drown the set in light and shoot this fucker.
Mm-hmm.
Which works just fine if you're shooting a lot of things, but it certainly doesn't give you any atmosphere. It doesn't give you any dread. It doesn't give you any mood.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I remember the last time I watched the Dan Curtis Dracula, I was just like, holy crap, everything looks like we're shooting a damn soap opera. For God's sake, find somebody to light this in a way that gives us some shadow.
Yeah.
Whereas you can't say that about this.
No, that's true. That's how I do. I do see what you're saying.
A lot of atmosphere
here. Yeah.
Well, good. We're not as far off as I thought we might be. God, you're doing that film? Holy crap, it sucks.
I know. Like, that's the sound of the NashiCast universe snoring out here, out there. Now, hopefully you managed to stay awake through this, though, because we've enjoyed talking about it.
Definitely. If we point some people toward this and you end up watching it for the first time and you think it sucks, hey, let us know.
Yeah.
But I will stand by my opinion on this. I think there's a lot of good stuff in this movie. I don't think it's great. I don't think it's fantastic. But I do think there's some wonderful stuff in it. Mm-hmm. So there you go. I think that'll wrap up our second Jess Franco Beyond Nashy episode. Or at least this portion of it. We're going to come back after a brief break and go through a couple of emails we've gotten from some folks. And we will leave you with that. Any closing thoughts on this sucker?
I'll say this. I was thinking about when we were listening to this back to sound clip of Van Helsing reading about Dracula. Somebody, if they haven't already out there, really needs to do a filmed montage of all the scenes from vampire films where somebody's reading the vampire lore, you know, where somebody reads the point in the film when somebody says,
"Oh yeah,
here's what a vampire is, here's who Count Dracula is," you know, I think you could take great film montage, you know, of all these different scenes.
Right. God, I wonder if in the great world of YouTube, if somebody's already done that.
It wouldn't surprise me. You could probably even manage to pace it so that they were all moving in the same, you know, because they're always walking around a room with a book, and I bet they would, you know, you could probably do it where it would blend right into each other.
I remember the scene from Coppola's. It was, he was standing at a pedestal with a book on this large reading pedestal.
You could throw in the scene from Count Dracula's Great Love where the girls find the book in the library and reading about it. You could throw in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein where he's reading Dracula's legend by his, you know.
While he's essentially sitting in the Frankenstein monster's lab.
It would be awesome, yeah. So yeah, but like I said, it may already be done. It may be out there in the YouTube
That would be hysterical if only I had the technical know-how and skill to do such a thing. But
anyway. So yeah, that was my completely last poignant thought. Don't Dracula. Well, that's probably not what you were looking for, but that's all I got.
I will just sum up by saying that this film proved nothing else to us. It proved that Jack Taylor takes blood to the face like a man.
He does. He does.
And even without the mustache.
I was going to say, and he shaved once in his life, it proved.
Oh, man, we got through this whole thing, and I didn't even mention Paul Mueller as Dr. Seward.
Oh, God, another great one in the cast.
Oh, God,
yeah.
That sucks. Paul Mueller was great in this film. But we'll wrap this up by saying, hold on, folks. Stay with us, and we'll do a few emails.
Blind terror strikes fear into the hearts of innocent people. The morgue receives the victims of the blind dead. There's no escape from the blind dead. They are the Templars, devil worshippers, a death cult that has risen from their thousand-year-old tombs to begin a horrible reign of terror.
Please wait!
Pop, look over there!
Oh,
beautiful young girl is trapped by the evil forces. No one is safe from their curse.
They're coming!
Human sound in the ancient cemetery brings the evil creatures from their tombs. The Templars perform their sadistic rites. A virgin is sacrificed in a blood ritual. Fiery death for those who can't escape the blind dead. Coming soon from your cemetery.
Hello, and welcome to a commercial for Hello, This is the Doom Show. I'm Richard.
I'm Brad.
And on the podcast that is known as Hello, This is the Doom Show, we talk about giallo movies, slasher movies, horror movies.
We're going to interview Cary Grant live in the studio.
We're going to interview Lucio Fulci in the studio, folks. We're going to put Cary Grant in the studio with Lucio Fulci. It's the interview you never thought would happen.
I'm going to wear my Vincent Price slacks.
I'm going to wear my Citizen Kane wristwatch and monocle. And now Brad is going to recite the Pledge of Allegiance in Portuguese. Brad, go.
I don't know Portuguese.
Go! Go!
Stop hitting me!
You're a natural actor.
Yeah.
You can listen to us at hellodoomedshow.podomatic.com, or you can find the archive at doomedmoviethon.com.
All right, so we're going to get to the mail here. And first up, we've got something from our buddy Chris.
Hello, Chris.
Hey, one of our old Dark Clubhouse brethren here.
Exactly.
He says, Rod and Troy, hope it's not too late to get in a comment on Virgin Among the Living Dead. Regarding the mysterious black dildo, I couldn't tell if you guys knew about this or not, but in the English dub, during the reading of the will, the lawyer is going through a quick litany of assets and properties of Christina's father. One of the items is an archaeological collection of ceremonial phalluses. Because the scene has a lot of humor in it, this at first seems like a throwaway gag, but it certainly explains the presence of the phallus later and the other characters' reverence for it. Keep up the good work, Chris. I did not listen to the...
Basically, the copy I have, I did away with the English dub.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically because it's not nearly as good. Mm. And I'm wondering if the English dubbers saw this bizarre thing and went, like, let's put that in.
Yeah, that's fascinating because I hadn't heard it either. That's really amazing to know that I don't know if that was
you know, the old VHS version of the thing we both first saw this film on may have it was obviously the English dub or we wouldn't know what the fuck we were doing. But I didn't remember that at all. I'm glad Chris wrote in to make mention of that because that is an interesting little tidbit of information about Virgin Among the Living Dead is somebody somewhere decided we need an explanation.
We're going to set this up for, exactly. Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Chris. And if you have any ceremonial phalluses, please bring them to the next Old Dark Clubhouse. In fact, I think that should be the theme of the next Old Dark Clubhouse, to be ceremonial phalluses. Sorry, folks, for you listening at home, I just about made Rod spray the walls with
green tea. That's not a good idea. Now, all I can think is that I hope to God Chris's wife doesn't listen to this podcast.
Oh, I know.
Because we will hear... Yes. So many freaking jokes about black phalluses and dildos and every freaking thing else under the sun. Oh, my God. It'll never end. She will rag our asses, man.
It might keep some of the riffraff out if they know that's what we've got in there. You know?
All we need is a big inflatable dildo. It's like 6 feet tall. Just to be seen carrying that into the hotel.
I always wonder if the Rolling Stones have that left over from their early 1970s tour where Jagger would ride the big inflatable penis out on stage. I always wonder what happened to that thing. Does Jagger just have that in his personal collection, or where did that end up? Did it end up in some like kid's fair somewhere, some like, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's like a float.
Ride the Phaelus.
It's the lake monster.
Somebody stuck a big dragon's head on it and what, yeah.
That's all kinds of wrong.
Yeah.
Oh Lord, yes. Thank you once again, Chris, for opening up the penis conversation. That's always good. Hey, we've stayed away from penis conversation for so long. All right. Got an email here from Brad. It says, "Thanks, fellas." He says, "Thank you very much for playing our promo." Of course, he and his cohort in crime, it'd be Richard and Brad, are the hosts of Hello, This is the Doomed Show, which we talked about in the last episode.
Yeah.
Kind of our sister podcast.
Very cool podcast.
You can find that over at Doomed Movie-a-thon. And he says, "The discussion of Vengeance was excellent as usual." That would be Vengeance of the Zombies. "I was afraid you wouldn't like it, but I will admit the first time I saw it, I didn't think a lot of it. Repeated viewings have improved the film in my estimation. Our new episode of our show is on symptoms, and it's up today, and we put your promo in it." Well, that's good to know.
That's awesome. Thanks, guys.
Bounce back and
Symptoms now, is that one you're familiar with, or is it?
I'm not sure what symptoms. Symptoms. I'm looking at the poster art, and I can't remember if I know that film or not, because I know of three different films with that title. That sucks. Without more information, I can't remember if I've seen Symptoms. I still need to listen to their Tourist Trap and Eyeball episodes. Eyeball being just an absolutely great film. And, of course, I cop music from it for the opening to the show.
Yeah, but just in case anybody was wondering.
Yeah. And, of course, Tourist Trap, I mean, you know. Chuck Connors is a I'm not actually a big fan of that film of Tourist Trap.
Yeah, but you had to admit that those like little doll like things were pretty damn creepy, you know, that are in it, to the little man, whatever they are.
It's a bizarre film and worth your time if you're a horror fan.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, now I'm losing myself. He says I was looking at Code Red's website, and The Dead Are Alive is indeed out of print. Now, The Dead Are Alive is the first film they did a podcast
on. Yeah, that's a really great episode. It really made me want to see that movie.
And the film and the DVD is out of print. And if you look on Amazon, people are selling copies of it now for like $70.
So I probably won't be seeing it for a while.
Yeah, tell me about it. He says, "I can't wait to hear your take on Count Dracula. You are brave, brave men." I don't think we're that brave. And now, if you've gotten this far in the podcast, you've heard our take on it. So there you go. He says, we really enjoyed your commentary on the giant behemoth. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I hope, like I say, I'm not sure how much crossover there is between Nashie fans and
we'll mention again, you can go to Rod's blog, The Bloody Pit of Rod, and he has a link to it up there if you want to download his commentary for the giant behemoth.
I reposted the link and the information about the commentary just about a week ago, so it should be fairly close to everybody's, the top of the page somewhere or another. Mm-hmm. He says, "Obviously you did a lot of research and work timing it out. It seems to me that the British sometimes took their classic sci-fi more seriously. I kept expecting Nashie or the Blind Dead to pop up. Have you thought of doing another Blind Dead film, I'm assuming.
Or another commentary. I'm not sure.
Another commentary. You're right. I think that is what he's talking about. Yes, for a long period of time, I was trying to convince a buddy of mine, our buddy Jeff, who does the artwork for each of our episodes, to do a commentary on The Hunter from the Future.
I would love to hear y'all do that, especially if it's a full 4-hour version.
Well, it's first of all, it's not actually 4 hours.
Okay,
long.
I know. I'm just
it's a little. It's almost three.
Yeah. Okay.
But okay. No, I was talking about we could only really sustain that for the theatrical edit, hour and a half long version. But for a couple of years, I tried to get Jeff motivated to do that because it's one of his favorite bad films. Well, bad in quotes films.
Bad that you love.
Oh yeah, you gotta love Yor the Hunter from the Future. That's just an incredible film.
Now that we've called Jeff out on the air, he has no choice but to do it.
But the thing is, it would take a lot of damn work. I'd love to see David Z do a track, maybe in collaboration with somebody else. on that particular film because he shares a lot of love for it as well. Mm-hmm. I've thought about doing it. So, yes, we've thought about doing commentaries. I've thought about doing commentaries. There's been talk of us possibly trying to edit something together that would be a commentary, but nothing definite yet, no. Although, if we did a Your commentary, I mean, they just brought it out on a burn-on-demand DVD, so now's the time. Strike while the iron's
Everybody
hot.
Everybody can watch it, yeah.
That's true. Back to Brad's email. Have you seen Queens of Evil with Ray Lovelock and Evelyn Stewart? Not technically a giallo, but it is an excellent film. I had to look this damn thing up. Queens of Evil. I didn't know this film at all. 1970. Directed by Tonio Cervi. The star, Ray Lovelock. Did not know this film at all. A young hippie drifter on motorbike is lured to his destiny at the hands of three stunning females residing in a hidden forest cabin.
Wow.
I'm already there, right?
Let's watch it. Yeah, I'm for it.
No, I don't. Brad, I don't know the film. Neither of us have seen the film. But one I would definitely be interested in checking out. Looks like I'll have to go the special antenna route,
yeah.
as I like to refer to it,
right.
to see it, because I don't see an easy way to get your hands on it. We'll discuss the special antenna a little bit more in detail here in a minute.
Yeah.
But the Queens of Evil I'm curious about but never have seen. So I will say that I have got a line on checking it out and probably will very soon. Back to his email. Sometimes I'd love to hear what your favorite Hammer films are. I get the feeling from things that you've said various places that you're very knowledgeable. Well, kind of knowledgeable. I'm planning to watch all the Frankenstein films in a marathon soon. We plan on doing an episode on Hands of the Ripper down the line. Thanks again, Brad. Okay. We've given a little thought to this Hammer question.
Yes.
Favorite Hammer films. That's a really fun discussion.
I was about to say,
have.
Yes, that is. That is.
If I had to, my two favorite Hammer films are not two that are generally thought of as soon as people mention Hammer movies.
Right.
My two favorites are always going to be Quatermass in the Pit and The Devil Rides Out. Not your typical, you know, they're not Dracula, they're not Frankenstein,
right.
so they're not even really technically the technically monster films. But yeah, those are my two favorites. Although I love a lot of the others.
Oh
what,
gosh, yeah.
What's your favorite?
My favorite would be Vampire Circus.
Really?
Love Vampire Circus. Of course, you probably could tell by how I was turning cartwheels when the Blu-ray came out. You know, I just
was
so thrilled when the Blu-ray came out. Probably Vampire Circus and Quatermass in the Pit would be my top two favorites. You know, Vampire Circus is really my favorite vampire film altogether. I'll just confess that right now.
Okay.
Because it's just so unusual, such a different take. And especially for Hammer, the way they kind of knocked their own formula totally on its ass by that film, you know, totally like gave up their usual trappings there or their usual plot formula and just kind of went in this totally different direction that was very interesting. Quatermass in the Pit, of course, just one of those classic Nigel Neal combinations of horror and science fiction that work so well.
Such a great script, so well, so well concocted. It's just such a it sticks with you and gets under your skin. And I just think it's great. Yeah.
After that, my next choices would probably be the ones that sound very typical, which would actually be The Horror of Dracula and Curse of Frankenstein that kicked off both the Frankenstein and Dracula series. I love those. I love The Mummy, their version of The Mummy. Devil Rides Out, you're right, that's fantastic.
It's a great film.
And one I have a real soft spot for, and now it gets criticized a lot, is Dracula Has Risen from the Grave. I mean, a lot of times when people talk about the Dracula films, they sort of say, yeah, they started off great with Horror of Dracula and Dracula Prince of Darkness, and then it kind of went downhill from there. But I think
What do you think of Brides of Dracula, the second Dracula
film? I think it's a very well-done film.
It has Peter Cushing as Von Helsing again, but doesn't have Chris Lee as Drac, and it doesn't have a Dracula. So.
Right, it does, yeah. And I enjoy that film very much. I think it's got some wonderful things there. That's very good. But the film that I saw most when I was really, really young, you know, before I was 10 years old or whatever, was Dracula's Risen from the Grave, because that was the one that on the afternoon movie, they would actually show that one quite a bit, and there wasn't many other Hammers at that time that they would. I had to wait. I did see Horror of Dracula once on Creature Feature when I was little. It scared the shit out of me. I loved it though. Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, I got to see quite a bit, so it will always have a real soft spot in my heart. And I still think it's a very good movie. I think it's quite, you know, I think
I like it quite a bit too. What's wild is I think that's one of the until I caught all of Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell in an afternoon screening on one channel or another when I was younger. I think Dracula's Risen from the Grave was actually one of the first of the Hammer films that I ever saw that creeped me out. And what got under my skin was that whole thing of Dracula being frozen in the ice and that blood trickling down through the ice. And going, you know, and that's what revives him. That stuck with me forever. I remember even talking about that with the kids at school the next day. I was in like third or fourth grade, and I can remember talking to the kids about that and about how that was really... I mean, we talked about it a lot. I mean, that was a really vivid thing, right? Yeah.
So that was probably my first exposure to the kind of hissing, snarling fanged Dracula, you know, that Lee played, you know, just that really great way that he played the character, you know, that very, very frightening way he played the character was probably my first exposure to that. Now, you mentioned Frankenstein, the Monster from Hell. So of the Frankensteins, is that your favorite of the Frankensteins?
No, it's not my favorite. I think it's fantastic. I love it. As a matter of fact, in general, I really, really prefer the Hammer Frankenstein films
me
to
too.
The Dracula
me too.
Films.
They're much more across the board stronger than the Dracula films are. Yeah. I agree with that. But like I said, my favorite is kind of, you know, it's kind of, actually the first one is my favorite of those.
Actually, my favorite, I tend to fall on the side of... the second one, I like Revenge. I think I like it better
Revenge
than the first
is,
one.
Revenge is very good. It definitely is.
Also like Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very strong one, even with the very effective but unnecessary rape scene.
Yeah, that's I know what you mean. That's uncomfortable, but...
It's. I mean, I think it's a very good film.
Oh, and neither of us have mentioned. I know we both love Curse of the Werewolf. I mean, that's
I'm
that's,
a big
that's
fan
a
of Curse of the Werewolf
film.
Some
of the best werewolf makeup ever. I just love the way the werewolf looks in that film. It's fantastic.
Plague of the Zombies, I think, is wonderful.
The Cornwall films are both very good.
Yeah, both Cornwall films. I think that. I'm of course a big fan of The Lost Continent. Mm-hmm. And I wish somebody would put that thing back out and give us a new DVD, because now the old DVD looks like, I mean, it really looks like crap these days. I like their version of She from 65 with Ursula Andress.
I
think it's a good movie.
That.
The Gorgon I enjoy. Mm-hmm. I think Scars of Dracula is terrible.
That was going to be my next question. I didn't really give enough thought to this. I probably would have to look at those. What is the worst? What do you think is the worst Hammer film?
That's a tricky one.
That is a tricky one. Because you can still, even the worst can still have elements that, you know, you could always sit down and enjoy on an October evening, you know, good Halloween film, even if it's bad, you know, like Scars of Dracula. I mean, it's, you know, it's got Christopher Lee's Dracula. You can always watch it.
And
it's got nudity.
It's got Patrick Troughton as his kind of slave that, you know, his slave slash familiar. And I love Patrick Troughton. I'm a big Doctor Who fan, of course. And there's that. But Scars is just really terrible overall.
Now I know you don't really like Dracula AD 1972 much, do you?
It's not that I hate it. It's just that it's like a 5 on the 1 to 10 scale. Yeah. It just doesn't have any
the
pop.
The campy factor doesn't appeal to you as much as I think it does to some other people like me. See, to me, that's like
actually,
a film that's like
I think
interesting.
If the campy factor was a little heavier, I might enjoy it a little bit more. It's just that past the opening sequence, I think the film just kind of lays there.
Like it doesn't do enough to exploit the fact that it's in
1972.
But see, that works. It does to me. It works to me on that. It's one that I just think is a really fun movie from start to finish. I get such a kick out of that one.
I don't think much of it. I mean, I don't think it's bad. It's just kind of lays there, which is kind of a shame for me. Captain Crono's Vampire Hunter, I think, is phenomenal.
That's a fun one.
That's a really great later one. I am a big fan of the full length version of The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
Me
I
too.
Think it's a bizarre experiment.
It is.
It works.
Oh yeah, I've always enjoyed that film a lot. I've always really have liked it. So yeah. As you can see, we could talk Hammer forever. So yeah, there's no question.
I would keep talking Hammer.
Until mentioned every single thing that came out, we would, you know, it's like it's true. So yeah, but good question. Thanks for getting it. It's always fun to talk Hammer films.
I
love this stuff.
I always love being able to look at the Hammer films and realize just how much I enjoy going back to them and revisiting them. They're just so much fun. There's always a level of joy to going back to them. Even the ones that are problematic, the ones that kind of stand out and are not as good as the others, there's something to them that will draw you in. It's like, it's always such a blast. Just a couple of years ago, we finally got to see the uncut Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll.
They're
Jekyll and Hyde. And it turned out to just be fantastic. I mean, I really was surprised. I mean, I think we've seen all, I mean, I think we've, I don't think there are many surprises left for, you know, the real Hammer aficionado who's really dug into everything and get his hands on. But we should probably stop talking about Hammer films now, because now it's just, I just want to go in the other room and like throw on one of the movies and check it out.
I always have to see a few of them during October, just like I always have to see a few of the Universal films. And if you're one of those people who feels you have to follow on either side of that argument, I know some people like that. We won't name
names. Are there still people like that? I mean, for fuck's sake,
there's one name.
What a waste of argument. I mean, that's pointless.
I think there's one name in particular. He's a pretty big name. I'm not going to say it. A big name among writers and but I think that's all kind of an act too.
It is a bit of an act. I mean, and
it's hard for me to really imagine. It's really hard for me to really imagine somebody seriously like.
Hating the Hammer films.
How can, or vice versa, loving the Hammer films and not liking the Universal films. Let's face it, they're both great. They both have their own strengths and
weaknesses.
So, yeah, I always got to watch some Universals, always got to watch some Hammers during October.
You know what I was just remembering?
Was it?
We raked Jess Franco's Count Dracula this episode. We rake it over the coals for the shitty bat on a string thing. I'm just remembering how much I love Kiss of the Vampire.
But it does have
some bad on a string stuff, especially there at the end. I mean, they edit it pretty effectively so that it doesn't look as bad as it probably should, but still. But it has that cool animated bat stuff. Yeah, that's a good film. Kiss the Vampire.
Check out Billy the Kid Meets Dracula if you want to see a great bat on a... Not only is the bat on a string, but they actually put the bat on a slanted wire so that when it comes to the scene, it's like a hang glider. It's like it's hang gliding down this wire into the scene.
Well, now you're reminding me of the Devil Bat, the Bela Lugosi film. The Devil Bat where that guy... They fly that damn big oversized bat thing into that guy, and it looks like he takes a body blow that would lay him out for a day, man. It's like, holy shit. Oh, God, I love the Devil Bat. What a freaking movie. That's one of my favorite Bela Lugosi performances. He's insane in that movie.
It is.
Just a little on the neck. On the tender part of the neck. Oh, I wish I could do a Lugosi voice. That's so fucking awesome. But there you go. We've now over-discussed the Hammer movies.
We've
degenerated into Devil Bat conversations.
Everybody's out there, shut up. Sum up.
Okay, do sum up.
We will sum up.
We like most of them. So there.
Yeah, that's the easiest way to answer your question, Brad. And thanks for writing. Thanks for asking us that.
Okay. Time to reel this mother in and put it to bed. Okay. Folks, this will draw 20.5, the Beyond Nashi Cast episode focused on Count Dracula, to a halt before we lose our minds. And we just like to thank everybody for listening. You really do. You keep us functioning. You keep us happy about what we're doing here. This really does make all the effort and work we put into this thing. It really does pay off when we get emails from you folks, we get feedback from you guys. It's really phenomenal. Thank you very much for listening. It's a blast.
Yeah,
really,
we do appreciate it. Were we supposed to say something about a small antenna? Did we forget that?
Oh, that's right. I forgot. Oh, one last thing. We did get another email.
Don't go away just yet.
I just was going to say, before we wrap this up, some people, one fellow in particular, and actually a couple of other folks have written in talking about how do we get our hands on some of these rather harder to find Nashi films and some of the movies that we talk about. And I mentioned the special antenna, which, come on, that's just my way of talking about torrent sites. Places like Cinemageddon and other things like that, where you can get your hands on things that just really aren't available otherwise. Things that they're not out on DVD. There's just no other way to see them. But there are other places to get your hands on them in a nice compact form called DVDs. There are a couple of sites I would point you toward. Diabolic DVD, you can get your hands on some pretty obscure stuff there. Also, Brian Horwitz's company called Trash Palace, you can visit there. There are a lot of other places around the net that you can find. They're essentially, if you can't get to... say a convention to meet bootleggers and kind of look through their stuff and get a look at it. These are at least a couple of places you can start your hunt online to hopefully locate some of these more obscure films and get your hands on it and be able to see them, because Yes, we'd all love it if there was an easy, simple DVD that we could purchase right off the shelf or click on Amazon and get that sucker immediately and get that thing right in your hand. But, you know, for a lot of this obscure stuff, yeah, that's just not going to happen.
Now, for the torrent universe there, just so people know, I guess the main issues with that is if you're going to get into that, you'd better have some space on your computer, right? Because you got to have a lot of space to devote to that while you're holding this, while you're downloading these films and that sort of thing. And then also, most of them work on kind of a quid pro quo basis, right, where you need to also be putting things on there.
Well, you need to be, you need to be seeding the stuff that, you know, when you pull something down, you keep it there so that other people can leech it off of you as well. It's a pretty simple process, but at the same time, it's also
consumes your life. Well,
I wasn't going to say consumes your life, but there is a downside to there is actually people, I will admit to you, a downside to being able to find and download movies that you only heard of, or movies that you just have never been able to even think of before. You're like, holy crap, that fucking thing exists.
The downside is never bathing, never sleeping, never having, never interacting with human beings.
I bathe at bare minimum once a week. bare minimum, and I use soap, so I don't want to hear any crap.
That's why the fan is pointed your way.
But check out Trash Palace, Diabolik DVD. Those are good places to start if you want these in nice, simple DVD or DVD-R form. Can recommend both those sites. There are others around the web. Check them out. Wow, we should, you know, we're pimping these sites for nothing. Nevertheless, I guess that will now finally wrap it up.
Finally wrap it up, yes.
Remember that our next regular episode here in a couple of weeks will be The Beast and the Magic Sword. That'll be our October offering on the Nashie Cast.
Got El Hombre Lobo coming back for October.
Damn straight, this time off to Japan.
Yeah, he's in his whatever supernatural TARDIS he uses, and he's heading off to feudal Japan. So.
Supernatural TARDIS, I like that. Supernatural TARDIS. So yeah, next
as
time,
opposed to a non-super, I don't know how that would work.
Well, I mean,
scientific TARDIS.
Scientific TARDIS. Yeah. That would be the TARDIS.
There you
right?
go.
Yeah,
there you go.
That makes perfect made perfect sense to me. I didn't feel any gears grinding in my head. So next time out, We're back to Valdemar Daninsky.
Mm-hmm.
Join us then. Remember, you can reach us at our Facebook page. You can write us at nashycast@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that'll wrap it up.
That does it.
Folks, thank you once again for listening. And we'll see you next time. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And go watch some scary movies. Ooh.